Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 24. Conspiracy to Murder. Towards the end of October 1878, a notice appeared in the Boston newspapers which greatly alarmed Daniel Spofford's many friends. Under the caption, "Mysterious Absence," it ran as follows. Dr. D.H. Spofford, the Christian Scientist, has been missing since Tuesday, October 15th, and much alarm for his safety is manifested. He had offices in Haverhill, Newburyport, and at Hotel Tremont, number 297 Tremont Street, Boston, and was last seen at the latter place in apparently good health and sound mind. The cause of his disappearance is beyond explanation. Dr. Spofford is about 35 years of age, has a light complexion and full beard, and wore dark clothes and black cochet hat. He was a member of the Grand Army in Newburyport and an Odd Fellow in Lynn. Any information regarding his whereabouts may be sent to the Boston Police or to A.A. Spofford, number 151 Essex Street, Lawrence. Shortly afterwards, a news item appeared in the press to the effect that Spofford's body had been identified at the morgue, and there was little doubt but that he had been foully done to death. Within a few days, Gilbert Eddy and Edward Ahrens were arrested in Lynn, charged with having conspired to procure his murder, and bail was set at $3,000. Only a few weeks previously, Mrs. Eddy had written to Spofford, her first letter to him in 17 months, a plea that he desist from, and a warning against the boomerang effect upon himself of the malicious mental malpractice which she said she could detect him directing against her. He had not answered her letter, and now she found her husband charged with being accessory to his murder. With characteristic energy, she rose to the occasion and tackled the question of bail. It was quite a problem. She herself did not have the money in cash, and her house would not be accepted in surety, as a part of the original mortgage still remained undischarged. Bancroft was willing to come to her aid, but his house, too, had still a mortgage on it, and so he was not available. Finally, Miranda Rice was accepted as surety, and Gilbert Eddy and Ahrens were released on bail. They had hardly got back to Lynn from Boston before the news reached them that Spofford had reappeared, as suddenly and mysteriously as he had dropped out of sight 3 weeks previously, and had visited his brother Albert that morning in Lawrence. The relief which must have followed the first amazement in the little household at Lynn was destined to be short-lived, for it quickly developed that Spofford had come back with a story which only made more definite the charges against Ahrens and Gilbert Eddy. The charge of conspiracy to murder still remained to be answered. Spofford's story, as pieced together from press interviews and subsequent court proceedings, was nothing if not lurid. One morning, early in October, according to his story, He was sitting in his office at number 297 Tremont Street when a knock came to the door, on opening which he was confronted by a heavy-set, rather brutal-looking man who said that he wanted to see the doctor. Spofford took one look at him and, deciding quickly that he was certainly not the type of man that would be looking for him, asked him if he was sure he was the kind of doctor he wanted to see. Whereupon the man produced one of Spofford's cards from his pocket, explaining that he had found it on the door of his, Spofford's, Newburyport office, and that if he was the man indicated on that card, then he was the man he wanted to see. That his name was James L. Sargent, that he was a saloon keeper, and that his business was very important. Rather doubtful, Spofford asked him to come into his consulting room. And when they were seated, Sargent launched at once into his subject by asking Spofford if he knew two men named Miller and Libby. When Spofford replied he did not, Sargent remarked bluntly, "Well, they know you, and they want to get you out of the way. Miller, the young man, says you are going with the old man's daughter, and he wants to marry her himself." He then went on to explain that these two men had offered him $500 to put Spofford out of the way, and had already paid him $75 in advance. He declared that while he was determined to get all the money, or as much of it as he could, he had no intention of risking his neck by killing Spofford, and that if Spofford would be sensible and just disappear for a little while, the whole thing could be settled satisfactorily. He then went on to make the surprising statement that he had already notified State Detective Hollis C. Pinkham and had asked him to watch the case. He told Spofford to think it over and let him know. As soon as he had gone, Spofford lost no time in going round to see Detective Pinkham, and found that Sargent had told him the same story. Pinkham declared, however, that he had paid little attention to the matter, as Sargent had a criminal record, and he figured that he was only attempting to square himself with the police by appearing in the role of a conscientious informer. He said that he would certainly look into the matter further, and Spofford went away. A few days later, Sargent appeared once again in Spofford's Tremont Street office, complaining that Libby and Miller were pressuring him. He had, he said, tried to get some more money out of them by telling them the job was done, and that he, Spofford, was already dead, but that they had sent a boy round to his office to investigate, and were now accusing him, Sargent, of playing them false. Something had to be done, and at once. He urged Spofford, now thoroughly alarmed, to go with him to his, Sargent's, brother's house at Cambridgeport, and hide himself there until he could collect the balance of the $500 promised him. Once again, Spofford consulted Detective Pinkham, who evidently advised him to comply with Sargent's suggestion, for the two set out at once for Cambridgeport. Spofford left Boston on October 15th, and for something more than 2 weeks kept in hiding in the house of Sargent's sister-in-law. Sargent had promised to come out from time to time to let him know how things were going, but he failed to do so. And at last, Spofford took his courage in both hands and returned to Boston, going first to the home of his brother in Lawrence. Meanwhile, Ahrens and Dr. Eddy, as he was now generally called, had been identified by Sargent as the Miller and Libby in the case. And although Spofford was alive and unharmed, they still remained charged with a conspiracy to murder him. It was in vain that they both insisted that they had never seen the man Sargent before, and repudiated the charge with the utmost vigor. They were held in bail of $3,000 for examination in the municipal court in Boston on November 7th. When the case was finally called on the afternoon of November 7th, a motley array of witnesses confronted the judge. Judge May, a well-known jurist in the municipal court. James L. Sargent, the central figure in the case on the side of the state, was a bartender with a criminal record. His friend and star witness, George Collier, was at that time under bond waiting trial on some particularly unsavory charges. While other witnesses for the prosecution were James Sargent's sister, Laura, who kept a disorderly house, and several of her girls, who, as it subsequently appeared, were needed to confirm evidence given by Sargent and Collier. H.W. Chaplin appeared for the prosecution, and Russell H. Conwell appeared for the defendants. Mr. Chaplin, in opening the case for the Commonwealth, contended that he would be able to prove directly that the defendants, Ahrens and Eddy, had conspired to take the life of Mr. Spofford, and that Sargent had been paid upwards of $200 toward the $500 promised him for carrying out their commission. The evidence may be briefly summarized. James L. Sargent testified that he had become acquainted with a man who called himself Miller, but whom he now recognized as the defendant Ahrens, some 4 months previously. That Miller, or Ahrens, was in the habit of coming to his saloon to tell fortunes, and that one day he told him that he knew of a good job where $300 or $400 could be made without much trouble. That he, Sargent, on inquiring what it amounted to, was told that he, Ahrens, wanted a man licked, and he wanted him licked so that he wouldn't come to again. But he wanted to be sure that the man who did the job was to be depended on. Sargent declared that he reassured Ahrens on this point. "I told him," he said, "that I was just the man for him." And Ahrens said, "The old man Libby, or Dr. Eddy, would not pay more than was absolutely necessary to get the job done, as he had already been beaten out of $75. I met Ahrens the following Saturday at the corner of Charles and Leverett Streets at 5 o'clock, and we walked down Charles Street into an alleyway. He said Libby was not satisfied and wanted to see me himself. And so we selected a spot in the freight yard, where he and the old man Libby would meet me in half an hour. In the meantime, fearing that the affair might be a plot of some kind against myself, I borrowed a revolver of a friend and got another friend named Collier to go with me. Collier secreted himself in a freight car with the door partially open so that he could overhear any conversation, and at the appointed time, I met Ahrens and a man who was known to me as Libby, but whom I recognize as the defendant, Eddie. Eddie asked me how much money I wanted to do the job, and I told him I ought to have $100 to start with. He asked if I would take $75 at the outset, and I said I would. He wanted to know if I would be square, and told him yes. He then said he had but $35 with him that night, which he could give me, and would send the remaining $35 by Ahrens on Monday morning. I told him, no, I must have the whole at that time. Just then, a man came walking down the freight yard, and Ahrens told me, in a quick tone, to meet him on Monday morning. I did so, and Ahrens passed me $75. A few days later, I met Ahrens again, and he said he would bring me directions where to find Dr. Spofford at his office in Haverhill and Newburyport. Sargent then went on to describe in detail how he delayed as long as possible getting into touch with Ahrens again, how he spent the money, and at last, when Ahrens got difficult and clearly could not be put off any longer, he met with him again. We went to the Tremont Hotel, Sargent continued, and Ahrens gave me $16, with which I went to the doctor's office in Newburyport. I did not see the doctor, but brought away one of his business cards. Came back and called at Dr. Spofford's office and had a conversation with him. I afterwards met Ahrens on the common by appointment and told him I had made arrangements to have the doctor go out of town. In a few days, he met me on the common again. He said I was playing it on him, and that the whole thing was a put-up job, for Dr. Spofford was in his office. He had sent a boy to find out. Sargent went on to tell how he met Ahrens several times, and that finally they agreed that Sargent should take Spofford into the country on the pretense that he had a sick child. Their plan, he said, was to take Spofford out on some lonely road and knock him on the head with a billy, afterwards causing the horse to run away, first entangling the body with the harness so it would appear that death was caused by accident. Sargent said he took the doctor to his brother in Cambridgeport and kept him there for about 3 weeks. As soon as the fact of his disappearance was published in the papers, Sargent said that he sought out Ahrens and told him that he had made away with the doctor and that he had done it at 7:30 the evening before. Sargent said that Ahrens replied that he had known this, that he had felt it, and had a way of telling such things that other people knew nothing of. He saw him several times afterwards, seeking to secure more money, and finally Ahrens agreed to do something more for him, met him at Lynn, and paid him another $20. Another witness was a woman named Jessie MacDonald, who said she had lived as housekeeper with Dr. and Mrs. Eddy for several months, that she had never seen Spofford, but that she had often heard Dr. Eddy speak of his persecution of Mrs. Eddy, and had on occasion heard Mrs. Eddy reading a chapter from the Bible which said that all wicked people should be destroyed. Sergeant Sister, the keeper of the house of ill fame, supported by the testimony of some of her girls, declared that Sergeant had a room in her house, that RNs had come there 3 or 4 times to see him, and that on one occasion Sergeant had given her $75 to keep for him, telling her that he was going away to her brother's house in Cambridgeport. Sergeant's sister was followed by the detective employed in the case, Hollis C. Pinkham. He told how Sergeant had laid the case before him, how he did not attach much importance to it at first, but told Sergeant to go ahead and find out what he could, how he had seen Sergeant and Ahrens in conversation together on the common, how he had followed Eddy to his home in Lynn, and how he had seen Sergeant go towards the door of Eddy's house there, how he had subsequently asked Eddy if he had arranged to have Spofford put out of the way, how Eddy had denied the charge, denied that he had ever been in Sergeant's saloon, and how Ahrens had likewise maintained, when questioned, that he had never seen and did not know Sergeant, and that he stuck to this even when he was confronted with Sergeant himself. Another detective on the case, one Chase Philbrick, testified to seeing Sergeant at Eddie's house in Lynn, saw him try to get in, but fail to do so. He confirmed Detective Pinkham's testimony. Finally came George A. Collier, the man who hid in the freight car in order to overhear the conversation between Ahrens and Sergeant. His testimony corroborated that of Sergeant. This closed the case for the Commonwealth. The defense, inasmuch as the case was one where only probable cause for suspicion was to be shown, offered no evidence. The Commonwealth, on the other hand, submitted no arguments, simply laying the chain of circumstances before the court and asking the court to decide whether or not the evidence was sufficient to show that the parties should be held to appear before the Superior Court. Judge May remarked that the case was a very anomalous one, but thought the evidence was sufficient to justify the parties being so held, and ordered accordingly, fixing the amount of bail at $3,000 each for the appearance of the defendants at the December term of the Superior Court. The case was never called. Anomalous as it certainly was, its final resolution, if so it may be styled, was the most anomalous part of it. Without filing any memorandum of his reason for his action, the district attorney decided simply to take no further action in the matter. The Superior Court record reads, "This indictment was found and returned into court by the grand jurors at the last December term, when the said Ahrens and Eddy were severally set at the bar, and having said indictment read to them, they severally said thereof that they were not guilty. This indictment was thence continued to the present January term, and now the district attorney, Oliver Stevens, Esquire, says he will prosecute this indictment no further on payment of costs, which are thereupon paid. And said Ahrens and Eddy are thereupon discharged, January 31, 1879. This decision on the part of the district attorney not to prosecute further the charges against Dr. Eddy and Ahrens precluded all possibility of a public exoneration through an effective defense. Between the date of the preliminary hearing in November and the time of the district attorney's nolle prosequi in January, counsel for the defense, largely through the efforts of Mrs. Eddy herself, had secured a complete confession from the Commonwealth's chief witness, George Collier, that the charges against Eddy and Ahrens were entirely false, and that there was not a word of truth in the story he had told on the stand. Before a justice at Taunton, under date December 17, 1878, Collier declared under oath, "I, George A. Collier, do on oath depose and say of my own free will, and in order to expose the man who has tried to injure Dr. Asa G. Eddy and Edward J. Ahrens, that Sergeant did induce me, by great persuasion, to go with him to East Cambridge from Boston on or about the 7th day of November last, the day of the hearing in the municipal court in Boston in the case of Dr. Asa G. Eddy and E. J. Ahrens, for attempting to hire said sergeant to kill one Daniel Spofford, and that he showed me the place and the cars that he was going to swear to, and told me what to say in court, and made me repeat the story until I knew it well, so that I could tell the same story that he would. And there was not one word of truth in it all. I never heard a conversation in East Cambridge between said Eddy and Ahrens and Sergeant, or saw them pay or offer to pay Sergeant any money. Signed, George A. Collier." There were several other depositions and affidavits making for complete exoneration. And on February 10, 1879, Gilbert Eddy wrote a letter to the Boston Traveler summarizing the case for the defense. It was published next day under a caption, "A Personal Vindication," and ran, "The confession of George A. Collier, one of the principal witnesses for Daniel H. Spofford, and against Dr. Eddy and E. J. Ahrens last October, came out on the 6th instant." But Collier's confession is only part of the evidence of the defense. There are other, and as direct testimony, a part of which is that a dozen witnesses are ready to testify they were with Dr. Eddy at Boston Highlands until 10 minutes of 6 p.m. on the very day and afternoon that Sergeant and Collier swore Dr. Eddy was with him at 5:30 p.m., bargaining to kill Spofford. The ride in the horse car from the Highlands to East Cambridge would occupy an hour, and when the doctor reached his residence in Lynn, there were company there who will testify They were waiting to see him to inquire about his class, and he reached home about 7:15, having taken the 6:30 train from Boston. Upon the lawyer pinning him down to a date, Sergeant swore he knew it was the day and hour that he stated, because a seizure was made in a rum shop on that day, and at the hour he claimed to meet Dr. Eddy and E.J. Ahrens. The records show that a seizure was made on the rum shop that he named, and at the hour he named, but that the aforesaid gentlemen were with him then, and there is proven a lie. Mr. Ahrens can show an alibi by several witnesses who were in the doctor's office in Boston, where he was at the very time. So the matter was closed. The whole case is still as complete a mystery as it was in that long-ago day. Every suggested solution is fraught with apparently inescapable objections. The possibility that it was a kind of double-crossing extortion plot on the part of Sargent to get money from Eddy and Ahrens, as well as Spofford, is vitiated by the fact that he never attempted to get money from Spofford, and apparently never got any from Eddy and Ahrens, as the whole story of their meeting was denied by Collier. Moreover, even if this were shown to be still a possibility, there would remain to be explained Sargent's dealings with the detective Pinkham. That this was a deep-laid plot on the part of Spofford to have this revenge on Dr. Eddy cannot be seriously considered, while it's vice versa, that it was a deep-laid plot on the part of Gilbert Eddy to have his revenge on Spofford is equally incredible. There is, of course, what seems to be the genesis of a clue in Ahrens' former reputed connection with the underworld, but it apparently leads nowhere. No attempt was made to extort money from Ahrens. And if the object had been to get him out of the way, the method chosen was so tortuous and uncertain as to place it outside the bounds of possibility. Mrs. Eddy, in her view of the case, quite definitely attributed the whole incident to mental manipulation, claiming that it only presented on a somewhat larger scale the same incoherent features to be found in other ruptures that had taken place in the development of her work. Incoherence was indeed characteristic of the case from first to last. As one commentator well said of it, "The evidence reads like the testimony heard in the nightmare of some plethoric judge."